You are listening to Breaking Boundaries with Brad Palumbo.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. I've got another great guest with me here this week. With me today is Zed Jelani. He's a heterodox liberal journalist who's written for The Intercept and the Center for American Progress and worked at the UC Berkeley Greater Good Center. Thanks so much for coming on.
Yeah, it's great to be here, Brad.
So the reason I wanted to have you on is because a while ago on another platform, we had a really interesting back and forth on the issue of income inequality. This is obviously a rising issue, I think, in the last couple of years or decade or so in our politics, both on the left with people like Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, but also on the populist right with people really concerned about the concentration of wealth and income in American society. And there is some dispute over the extent of income inequality in the U.S. It depends how you count it. Some people would take issue with, say, Thomas Piketty's data that he uses, but we can agree there is a large level of income inequality in the United States. But what the conversation that I hope we can have again is that something people should care about? So just to maybe briefly introduce your position. So you don't believe in absolute equality or absolute inequality, but you think, so you accept some level of inequality as natural or even good, but you think that only once it rises a certain level, that's when it becomes dangerous or bad. Do I have that right?
Yeah, so inequality, as you said, it can be good in some regard. When we go to a soccer game, we want to see one side win, right? I remember going to the Olympics when I was a kid. It was in Atlanta. I lived in that area. And I went to, I think it was a field hockey game, and neither side scored, and it was 0-0. And it was a very dissatisfying outcome, right? To see no one actually win the game. Competition does produce better outcomes in general. Maybe it's not for every single thing that can go too far, but it does tend to produce better outcomes. So I think that, yeah, I think outside of the extremes, you know, there may be people who have a completely Marxist view of the world, or you know, people who got to the last page of the Communist Manifesto and said, okay, this is possible, this is achievable, this is what we're going to get to. But for most people, I think they do accept that there will be some level of inequality, and that inequality can even be beneficial. However, there are aspects of it that produce social problems, and those problems are worth addressing, I think. And even beyond, okay, so there's like a related problem. So some people argue, I think conservative economists or libertarian economists tend to argue this, and I think they make a fair point. They say we should worry more about people at the bottom, like if they're gaining or not, or we should worry more about poverty, but we shouldn't necessarily worry about inequality. Like if some people are extremely rich, but then the other people in the middle class and lower are actually gaining, it's okay, even if there's widening inequality. I disagree slightly with that, because I think there are some problems that are created almost in and of themselves from growing inequality itself, the gap as much as like the absolute positions. I don't think it's the whole ball game, but it is worth paying attention to for some reasons.
So that's kind of where I start on the issue, is there are types of inequality I think are bad, but I start from the position that inequality of itself is not just not bad, but good. People aren't the same and they don't deserve the same. And I know you don't advocate for everyone to be exactly the same, right? You're not a communist. But I guess I also very much appeal to that kind of, we could look at poverty as a relative metric, or we could look at poverty as an absolute metric. And I definitely prefer the latter, because to look at, I kind of think of it like this. If you tomorrow woke up and your next door neighbor had twice as much money, and this is adjusted for inflation, of course, right? Mm-hmm. Your quality of life, your standard of living, your day to day would not change at all. But inequality would have increased. How are you worse off?
Yeah, I don't think, like I said, I don't think in every single circumstance is it necessarily a problem, or is it going to cause a problem. And in some cases, as societies grow more unequal, they actually probably do improve on average. Like China is one example. Like China is more unequal today than it was in 1990, but it's a much better off place than it was in 1990, right? Because now it has a large middle class, and the fortunes of so many people have improved so much, right? That being said, maybe not in your example, it would necessarily be relevant, but it is generally shown that higher levels of inequality can lead to less life satisfaction, can lead to increased crime. In fact, inequality has a bigger correlation to crime, I think, than poverty does. Like countries that are very poor but relatively equal don't tend to have that much crime. But countries that have a lot of inequality tend to see more crime. Like when you look at a place like South Africa, right, versus a place like Vietnam or something. So there are some stressors it does place on people, particularly when they don't see, when they see the trajectory, right? Like we talk a lot about working class people, talk maybe about the white working class. Like I think one reason that population has seen so much alcoholism, drug overdoses, suicide, so on and so forth, is because I think they're seeing a relative kind of falling behind other people, even if in some ways maybe they've on an absolute level improved, just as technology has improved and other things have improved over the past few decades. But they're seeing kind of their status decrease and a bigger gap between them and maybe college-educated people. So I think that type of inequality can wear people down in a way. And I think it's been shown that it can wear people down and can cause some social problems. It doesn't mean that the solution is total equality, because that can be just as miserable for people, right? To not be able to compete and not to be able to show any gains for themselves or actually stand out. But there are some problems that I think are independent that can be caused by inequality in and of itself, independent of like poverty or lack of opportunity or something like that.
Right. So I guess my first thought is to question whether these social problems are necessarily correlated or a causal relationship, in the sense that, mm-hmm. is South Africa have a high crime rate because it is unequal, or is it unequal because of underlying tensions of racial issues and all sorts of other things that also cause a higher crime rate? So I wonder to what extent that is, because I would be surprised. I mean, it just runs against what I would expect to see from the concept of human nature, that absolute poverty would not correlate stronger to crime or violence than relative poverty. And do you think to some extent, it's not just about inequality, but it's also about opportunity? When I think of the white working class, the hillbilly elegy, the people of the world, the reason they're bitter and they're suffering from understandable problems and social strife, to me, it's not just because people in California have more, right, or the professional class is doing better, but it's because they don't have opportunity. What do you make of that?
Well, there's two things. One, I think sometimes we interchangeably use these things like opportunity and inequality when we really mean one or the other. And so I am really trying to make a distinction here, just to be fair to the argument about inequality, because I do think when it's studied, like, Robert Sapolsky is a really good like neuroscientist. He wrote a really great book called Behave, which just goes into like human biology and everything. And he has a good section in his book about inequality. And it actually, like when they studied it, independent of absolute levels of income, like inequality tends to predict higher rates of crime, homicide, incarceration rates in the United States, higher rates of like teen pregnancy, lower literacy. And that's independent of like the absolute levels of income. And I think it does kind of relate to what you're saying, because I think if your inequality is just you seeing other people improve their lives a lot and you're not improving your lives very much, that's going to have, I think, a psychological impact on people in a way that would be different if, let's say, the rich were getting richer, but you were also on a good trajectory yourself, right? So maybe the compromise here is to say it's not just absolute income, but it's also like your growth, right? Like, are you growing? Are you going somewhere? Because it tends to be that if wherever you are in society, if you have a sense that things are improving for you, like your kids are going to have a better life than you, I think things tend to be better for you than if you think you're sliding backwards and you see other people going forwards. If everyone was growing at a pretty good clip, I don't think it's as much of a problem. There have been times in U.S. history when we saw like really good wage growth for everybody. And yeah, richer were getting richer, but everyone was getting richer, like, 1950s through 1970s. And I think we see a lot of that in other countries as well. I raised the China example earlier. China is technically more unequal now than it was in 1990. But they saw such an increase in standard of living for people across the board that the fact that other people were getting richer wouldn't bother you as much if you were also getting richer, right? But that's still a form of inequality because it's based on your trajectory. It's not absolute inequality, but it's like maybe relative inequality. I wouldn't know exactly how to explain it, but I think, it does matter if other people are doing a lot better than you and you see them you see them continually improving your life while you feel like you're kind of stuck in place or you're in a rut or something like that. I guess that's more of what people who study this say, more than necessarily arguing that just because somebody's richer than you, somehow your life is worse. It's really about how much are you growing? Where are your opportunities? You know, do you feel like you're improving even if other people are improving more? You know, that kind of thing. So,
right. So I think that's an important point, because I personally make a big distinction between two different types of inequality. So there's one, the type of inequality I am perfectly okay with is the inequality that is created by competition and success, right? So if you just work harder in a free marketplace and do better and you have the more talented product, you put more hours in and you make twice as much money as your competitor, that's unequal. I'm okay with it. The kind of inequality that I really strongly oppose and would be with you on, and I think, though, I will say, I don't think the progressive left makes any distinction or often doesn't in their rhetoric, is kind of the corporatist inequality, right? Where you have corporations that are getting slushy welfare checks from the taxpayer, or big regulations that are protecting kind of big tech giants or other big companies from competition. And then they're seeing concentrated wealth that's coming because of corrupt government interventions or regulatory capture and all of this, and that sort of thing. So do you make the same distinction in kind between those two, and for one? And then two, do you have any sense to what extent the inequality in the United States, how much is of one kind and how much is of another?
Yeah, I do make a distinction between those two types of inequality. I do think the first can at extreme levels be harmful, through concentration and, you know, so on and so forth. The second is more pernicious because, so, okay, I'll relay an anecdote to you. In 2016, I reported a lot of stories about Hillary Clinton. And one of those stories I reported were how much money she made from speaking fees after leaving government. The reason she was making all that money, because she was in the government. She was basically selling access from information in government to people who wanted a private audience with her. When I wrote those stories, I think there were some Democratic partisans who basically thought I was reporting about her because she was rich, because there was something wrong with being rich. And they didn't find this persuasive. They were like, what's wrong with making money? People said the same thing when Obama did some of this after he left presidency. And I had to clarify to people that the complaint I'm making is not that these government officials were getting rich after leaving office. The criticism comes, the reason this reporting, I think, hit some nerves and did actually make quite a few people upset about her, and other politicians have reported on about this, is because they were trading a privileged government position that the people of the United States gave them for something from the private sector, which maybe wouldn't have been given to them if they didn't have the government position, and maybe also impacted the way they behaved in government. You know, the same way we see the revolving door between defense contractors and the Pentagon, right? You know, it may be that if you're hired from Boeing, you will give Boeing more contracts when you enter the government. Or when you leave the government, Boeing will give you a huge salary to give them information about how to get contracts or something like that, right? So that second kind of inequality, to me, is more pernicious, because it's not necessarily based on creating value to the wider public, making more efficient markets, getting better products to people. It really is selling privileged access to things that you only received because you had a purging government that the people gave you. And it can impact public policy, and I think it does impact public policy. When Medicare Part D was passed, for instance, the congressman from Louisiana, I believe he's from Louisiana, who helped pass that legislation, he specifically wrote it so that, like, the government can't bargain for better prices from drug companies, but it's going to be paying for all those drugs through Medicare. So this is a really sweet deal for drug companies. He immediately left and started working for the pharmaceutical lobby's group. And he earned millions of dollars a year doing that. You don't earn that much being a member of Congress, right? That, I think, rubs people in a very wrong way. And that type of inequality, I do think, is more pernicious, because it's not really based on, like, you just put out a great product or service and people like it and you're improving the world. It's more like you're selling some kind of something that was handed to you by government, and which honestly often makes the world a lot worse, because you're cutting corrupt and cronyist deals to do it. So,
No, look, you're not going to get any disagreement from me there, but I would point out that the key distinction is government, in the sense that a free market doesn't have those sorts of distortions. But for example, when you have a company that lobbies for tariffs, those tariffs in total hurt the economy. They kill more jobs than they create. But the government intervention helps specific businesses get ahead, and it interferes with competition. That creates a form of inequality. A group benefits from it and gets a financial windfall, and other people are hurt by it from this government intervention that, like you said, has no relation to value creation. And that is absolutely, I agree, a real problem. But at the same time, I'm left scratching my head, because the same people who are always talking about income inequality and inequality of wealth are people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Bernie Sanders. And I don't pretend to know all your policy positions, but those people want more regulation, more government intervention. They don't want a free market where the only inequality would be from competition. They want even more crony and government involved. They want all sorts of ways of picking winners and losers. And I guess they say, well, we'll do it in the name of the working class, but is that really realistic? Isn't that kind of contradictory?
Yeah, I mean, I think the distinction, though, is that they believe that government can be used for purposes that are not as corrupt as the ones that you described, right? Like, they think that, you know, the post office, or they have you probably don't have a high opinion of public schools, but they probably have a higher opinion of public schools, right? They imagine it being a tool that would benefit most people, rather than, you know, cutting sweetheart deals with the Halliburtons or the pharmaceutical industries or Amazon. And by the way, Ocasio-Cortez did campaign against Amazon getting a really sweet tax deal in New York City.
Yeah, I agree.
That was a big part of the reason they didn't go there. Which, by the way, I live in Northern Virginia, and Virginia, you know, really paid a lot of money to have Amazon come over to our neighborhood and, you know, sit. Have a loud construction all day and night, and basically, you know, we're paying them to come here, which we wouldn't do for the average business. I mean, it helps to be Jeff Bezos, I think, when you're trying to manipulate governments to get those deals. But yeah, I think the distinction is they would believe, and to some extent I agree with them, not always, but to some extent I agree with them, that there are things that government can do that aren't just going to be corrupt sweetheart deals that just benefit, like, the wider public. Like, you know, I don't think that building public roads is necessarily a sweetheart deal for a company or particularly corrupt. It just benefits everyone. In fact, it helps the market. You know, by having these roads, we have a means of doing commerce with each other, right? There's a number of things like that, right? So
I bet that if you went and dug through the history of infrastructure policy, you could find all sorts of handouts
You're right. There are, in fact, I can probably think of some if we, you know, back when we were talking like railroad companies and things, but I guess people form their political ideology through theory, right? And so I'm trying to explain the theory of why.
Right.
The iconic theory, the idealistic theory about why they have those beliefs. So
I guess I just don't think their theory is at all realistic, because I look at the fact that Obamacare, for example, was endorsed by the insurance lobbyists and the insurance lobby. Now, Obamacare was at the time, progressives pushing for the government to help people. And there's all sorts of ways. You could talk about some good Obamacare's done, some consequences, some pros, but it was endorsed by the whole, like, professional industry lobby. They wanted this. They benefited from this in all sorts of crony ways. So I just think that this idea that government will ever not be used for the well-connected and the well-off and powerful's benefit, I just think personally, I think that runs against just the record of what we've seen with most government programs.
Yeah, and I do think that there is a record like that. And it's not useful for people to deny that it exists, because I think a lot of the skepticism of government is well-founded. Like, if you look over the last 20 years, and you and I were just complaining about Amazon, how they manipulate the government. But if you asked me who has done more for the world, Amazon or the U.S. federal government, I would probably say Amazon over the past 20 years in terms of what they did in terms of transforming the economy, getting access of goods and services to people, so on and so forth. So I think much of the skepticism is well-founded. And I'm not someone who's knee-jerk going to defend the institution. on the other hand, I do think it has done some things well. I do think, you know, I cited infrastructure at times as an example. I think that in terms of distributing certain types of social supports, it's been fairly successful. And I think that if you look around the world, probably other governments have had more success than we have in recent times in terms of producing outcomes. There's one example, you know, I think the left really likes the Nordic countries, right? They like Sweden, Norway, Finland. And what's funny is I think libertarians kind of like them too, because there are some things they do that are somewhat libertarian. So for instance, like Sweden, right? Uses government subsidy to give families generous paid leave when they have a child. I think that's a very good pro-family policy. They have a very efficient and effective, I think, healthcare system that they've created that deals with people's illness very well. But, you know, they do things that are very libertarian as well. Sweden does not have any minimum wage, for instance. Government plays no role in doing that. Sweden right. also uses basically a voucher system for its schools. So, like, you go where you, you know, wherever you choose for your education. So, you know, it's a more of a mixed model than I think some of the people on the left would want to admit. But I think the mixture works fairly well. Like, I think they spend a fair bit on their welfare state, but they also let the market run fairly unfettered in other areas, which has allowed them to create really successful businesses like IKEA, who's obviously one of the biggest examples, but there's others. So, you know, I mean, I think there's something to be said for your side of the argument. It does produce real wealth, but I think that some of the market interventions actually have been fairly successful when they've used, not always, but they, I think there are good examples here in the United States and elsewhere. So
the Nordic example is a good one, and it's a really interesting one because, like you said, it really, both sides think it suits their narrative perfectly, and it really doesn't. So, like, the Nordic countries, actually, if you look at the welfare state, the taxes and the redistribution, it looks very progressive. If you look at the regulation and the low business taxes, it looks very laissez-faire. It actually ranks higher than the US in terms of laissez-faire. So they create all this wealth and then they redistribute it with a bigger welfare state than we have here. But I would point out that a lot of progressives in America don't, that's not what they're advocating for, right? They're advocating for the welfare state, but also a very government managed and intervened economy, hiking the corporate tax, you know, a $15, $20 minimum.
And here's another area where we may agree in that, you know, I don't think corporate taxes are really all that useful, because the reality is the main thing they do is they change corporate behavior. They get businesses to move their money out of the US or into some other arrangement. Because my preference for taxing is I'm more into the income taxes, and wealth tax has kind of a mixed record, but yeah, worth looking at it. But I don't think business taxes have a great record in the United States. And honestly, I do think, looking back at the tax bill that was passed by President Trump in the Congress, it did do some solid things. I think it did probably increase our economic growth a little bit. Yeah, and it probably did increase jobs. And I think those are good things. Of course, if I had my druthers, I would have increased taxes on individuals to some extent to make up for the revenue and to capture some of it. But I think you're right. I think much of the Western European success has been with lower corporate tax rates than America historically had, right? Now the situation has changed after the 2017 tax law. So it's a different story. But yeah, and I guess that's the way I approach these things. I try to be evidence-based in the way I'm approaching it. My value set is probably somewhat towards, I have a bias towards thinking about the underprivileged and so on and so forth. But in terms of the actual policy that's being implemented, I try to be somewhat evidence-based, because I do think sometimes the left is well-meaning, but they do enact policy that ends up being counterproductive. And I do think, like, the corporate tax rate we had before all this was counterproductive, because it was leading to more tax avoidance, which is not what we want, right? We want to be able to capture tax so we can fund stuff. Right. And we also want to be able to create jobs. We don't want people moving out of the country because they hate our tax rate and it's cheaper in Europe. So
one thing that's interesting is that once Trump did the corporate tax cut, it became a very polarized thing. But if you go back 6-7 years, Obama wanted to lower the corporate tax, not as much as Trump did, but Obama wanted to lower it to 26%. Right. It's actually something of consensus among economists left and right,
right,
that corporate taxes are not the best way to go and that they're often borne out now, by workers.
I would add something, though, that Marco Rubio was in the Senate at the time, right? And yeah. I think he tried to edit the bill to make the corporate tax rate a little bit higher, so that you could pay for like child tax credits and things like that. Like, I think those are actually like really good policies. Like the earned income tax credit's a fairly decent policy. Child tax credits are good policies. So, you know, if I was writing that bill, I probably would have made it a little bit more progressive. Maybe have the rate a little bit higher so that we could fund other things I think are good for working families. But I do agree with like the wider thrust of what Obama, as you said, Obama argued this when he was president, Trump argued it when he was president, that corporate taxes were too high in the United States, because if you looked at the rate was higher than just about anywhere in the world. Like it was. And it doesn't mean that corporations always paid those taxes. Of course, they would use all kinds of machinery to dodge them and to lower their liabilities. But then that also showed why the rate wasn't effective. Like, you know, it was self-defeating. So I agree with the thrust of it. Although if I was writing it, I would have written it a little bit more progressive, just to fund some of those other things. And I think Rubio made a good point with regards to that. So,
yeah, I don't know a ton about a family policy, but I can at least see the thrust behind that, as in terms of if you care about inequality, that might achieve something. But one thing that does kind of make me scratch my head is, even if I conceded all your adopted your exact position and AOC's position on income inequality and these other things, then they go, and you actually had a great Wall Street Journal op-ed about this particular one, but then their top agenda issues, some of them, like canceling all student debt, it's actually a regressive policy. There's a study from the University of Chicago that says the top 20% of income earners would get 6 times more financial benefit from student debt cancellation in full than the bottom 20%. So, and that's just one example, right? But even things like the $15 minimum wage is very debatable whether that would actually help workers. So I see a lot of their so-called solutions, the policy solutions to inequality, as things that would either be worse than inequality or have such strong other policy trade-offs that they're not worth it. But what is your kind of view on that?
Yeah, I mean, okay, so this is another thing where I think that the left often makes arguments about like altruism and selfishness. Like, you know, we need to do more for others. We shouldn't be so selfish. And, you know, I am generally agreeing with the thrust of that like moral argument, right? Like that's why I support bigger welfare states. And, you know, I want to see more antitrust and make sure companies don't get so big, more competition, and so on and so forth. But I think that, you know, something they're shy to admit is that it hits a certain point for them as well, to where they're not 100% altruistic, right? Like nobody is. Like we all have some amount of self-interest, unless you're, I don't know, an ascetic monk somewhere in a monastery or something. But like, and you know, I think that, so the student debt thing's an example. Like they want the government to it would probably cost around $1.6 trillion to just wipe out all the current student debt. Of course, you would only do it one time, and then it would just accrue again, and you're not changing the underlying system, so you're going to get run into the same problem again. But if you do that, that $1.6 trillion, as you mentioned, will go primarily to the better off people in America. Yeah, some lower income people will get it, because some lower income people have gone to college and have accrued debt, but most of it will go to more well off people. It's been studied many times and no one's ever found anything different. If you were being truly altruistic, we were saying we were going to spend money just to help the least of these. We don't want to, you know, we're not for the rich. We care about inequality. What if you took $1.6 trillion and like expended it the same way Bill Gates expends his money, right? Bill Gates has spent a ridiculous amount of money like on vaccines and inoculations for poor people in the developing world. He's wiped out entire diseases, basically. If you spent that money that way, it would, if you're taking a pure like Peter Singer altruistic argument, utilitarian argument to its end, that would be the proper way to spend that huge a chunk of money if you just want to spend money on good. Spending it on student debt is actually a very selfish way to spend it, right? It's actually largely benefiting people who made investments that turned out well for them. Like because they went to college and spent that money, they now have higher paying jobs as, you know, doctors, lawyers, engineers, so on and so forth. There are, of course, horror stories of student debt. There are people who, particularly people who went to college but didn't graduate, didn't really get much of a benefit from it. But the bulk of it, the bulk of that money would still go to people for whom this was a good investment. And they're making more money as a result of it. So you're just giving them even more money, right? Because you're paying down their investment as well. Not just what was produced by the investment, but the investment itself. So it wouldn't actually be a very altruistic thing to do. And that's what really bothered me about it. Even though, I concede myself, like most of the policies I'm advocating for are to benefit Americans. You know, if I was 100% altruistic, I'd be saying we need to be giving all our money towards the poor in other places in the world who have it much worse than the poor in America. But I do think this particular pot of money would be, if they did what they wanted to do, would be primarily spent on people who really just don't need it. And I do think it's just a recognition of the fact that the left in America is mostly college-educated people. They're people who are generally in white-collar fields and institutions like universities, courts of law, nonprofits, those kinds of things. And I think most of them just aren't that interested in commerce and business and like the actual really existing working class small businesses, so on and so forth, which this pot of money would largely pass over. I mean, maybe they'd get a little bit of it. I mean, there are, you know, because we have so many people going to college now versus were in the past, you do see more lower income people accruing student debt now than before. But still, primarily it's not them. So that was my problem with this. I felt like this policy was a government policy that would increase inequality, basically, and it's like that if we ever are going to be using government policy, I certainly don't want it to be going in that direction. So,
right. So that's, I guess, part of what I find really frustrating about this debate is people like AOC or Bernie Sanders in the same 3-minute speech clip, right, from one of their rallies or a video that Sanders puts out on his, he's very good on social media, got to give him that. They'll talk about income inequality and the 1% and all this, and then they'll go and rattle off and say, and that's why we've got to cancel student debt. And I'm like, that's literally a net regressive policy. But so I think we agree there. So I want to shift based on something that you just brought up that I find really interesting. You talk about Bill Gates and the unbelievable altruism that he has done. But one thing that I believe from the free market economic point of view is a Keynesian and progressive fallacy, is the idea that government dollars essentially can be created out of thin air to some extent. I believe very much so that for every dollar the government spends, that's a dollar that's taken from someone else or taken from future resources via debt. So like you just mentioned, in order to take money away to pay for student debt cancellation, or even to pay for something that was progressive, that wasn't regressive, you have to take a dollar away from someone like Bill Gates, from someone like Tim Cook, from someone like the late Steve Jobs, or not even just those people, right? Because you run out of the riches money pretty quick, but you have to take it from upper middle class people, doctors, lawyers, etc. But so there's this kind of inherent conceit in that they think the money, the quote unquote 1% would be allocating it for, it's like they don't talk about the trade-offs there. If you took all the money from Jeff Bezos, that includes all his charitable initiatives. So whatever benefits from your progressive policies you're funding with it, but you have to weigh those costs too. And I, for one, tend to think that private sector and private charity, dollar for dollar, is a heck of a lot more efficient than government programs that are intended to help people, because I don't know, many people would argue the welfare state is not, even if you support it, prone to inefficiency and fraud.
Well, also, yes, private philanthropy, if you've been involved in it, is also prone to inefficiency and fraud at times. It's not perfect either. However, like, look, I think it was Oxford had a debate about billionaires, and I think it was like, should billionaires exist or something? Which was something that AOC's like policy guy Dan Riffle like started a meme on Twitter about, like, billionaires shouldn't exist, and like suddenly it became like everyone on the left is saying it. And when Oxford had that debate, what was really interesting was that Peter Singer, who I cited before, who's like me, he's someone who is generally in favor of more redistribution, welfare state, so on and so forth, he took the position that they should exist actually. And what he did is he picked Bill Gates exactly, And he argued that Bill Gates is an effective altruist because of the way that he's spending his money. So, yeah, if you ask me if billionaires should exist, I am actually okay with them existing. But if you ask Bill Gates, should billionaires pay higher taxes? He also agrees that they should pay higher taxes. Like, he and his father actually have both supported campaigns within Washington State for, like, a higher income tax, for instance. Like, he's not opposed to that. But I think what makes... I think that one distinction of why I'm generally more friendly to a Bill Gates versus some other people is that Bill Gates is spending his money. Like, you could argue Bill Gates is spending his money in a more moral way than the U.S. federal government is spending their money right now, given the policy priorities of both. Because Bill Gates, you know, he's basically dedicated himself to spending like half of his money, or he's trying to get people to give half their money to these causes that they generate over their lifetime and their wealth. You know, the U.S. federal government spends like, I don't know, less than 1% of the federal budget on foreign aid or something. And he's spending, you know, so much that he's wiping out diseases. So to some extent, the government is just a reflection of the social priorities of the United States as well, because I don't think that, you know, I don't think Americans want to give so much money to something like fighting malaria in, you know, West Africa or whatever. Bill Gates does want to do that. So having private sector philanthropy does allow, even if it's one individual who's taking a cause that's not particularly popular, because he has so much money personally, he's able to do that. So I do think philanthropy is a defensible sector. And I know a lot of people like have written entire books criticizing it and wanting to eliminate it basically and put it all within the government. I think it's important to have philanthropists because they can do things that are independent of the government. Even if the wider political system is not in favor of a certain cause, you know, a philanthropist can even take on an unpopular or an uncommon cause, right, that you're never going to be able to lobby the government to get behind. So I'm not against philanthropy.
But so the billionaires question is an interesting one, because I know that you don't oppose billionaires, but people like AOC, they literally say billionaires shouldn't exist. Or my favorite one is every billionaire is a policy failure. I find this amusing because I think, from my point of view, the mistake that they make with that line of thinking is thinking of economic wealth creation as a zero-sum game. So, like, think of Steve Jobs as an example. He became a billionaire. I think he died with a net worth of $10 billion. But in doing so, he literally made hundreds of thousands of jobs for other people in pursuing his own profit. He innovated technology that we all use and benefit from, satisfied millions of consumers, and no doubt created much more wealth for the overall economy than he did actually that went into his bank account. So it's like, if you wanted to stop income inequality by having, like AOC, a 70% top marginal tax rate, well, someone like Steve Jobs would never have happened with a 70% top marginal income tax rate, right? He would have made his first $5 million. And then what are you going to do? Just keep working for basically nothing after that? So in eradicating income inequality or reducing it with these kind of punitive, sometimes it really just seems like this progressive left just dislikes wealthy people and is just doing policy because it makes sense, but just because they have.
And that's where I think I find more agreement with you, in that I don't think any public policy should be based on envy or resentment of any kind, whether it's about wealth or about race, of course, or gender. Or once you start going down that road, you really end up promoting policy that may not end up making everyone better off in the end, but you're just trying to hurt someone because you don't like them for some reason. And I totally agree with you on that. That's not the right way to approach it. But look, I also think if you look, it's funny, I actually cited this when AOC said the billionaire thing. I was like, would you rather live in a country with billionaires or without them? So if you look at the list of countries in the world, it's, you know, Germany, the United States, you know, Western Europe, so on and so forth, China and Russia are the countries with the most billionaires. And then the countries with the least, you know, are going to be places in Africa, Latin America, you know, Central Asia, so on and so forth. It's pretty obvious the countries with billionaires are better places for everyone for the most part. With the exception of probably Russia, but that also probably would speak to your point, because a lot of that wealth was basically stolen when the Soviet Union fell apart. That was not a free market wealth. So, you know, that does speak to your point. But I would also, you know, to my point, I would add that most of the countries with high numbers of billionaires tend to have pretty decent social safety nets, good public investment in various things. Germany is a great example. I think it's maybe number two or three in terms of number of billionaires. And I think they have a very good system of education, including vocational training as an alternative to college, where they partner with companies, has good labor and union rights, sectoral bargaining, things that I think keep a very healthy middle class in places like Germany. I think if you want to go to a hospital in Germany, it might cost you, I don't know, $10 or something for a copay to stay overnight or something like that. I think that, you know, the two things can coexist. You can have a country where people are rewarded for innovating, for putting out great products and services for people, where people feel like there's a real reason to compete and to strive, but also that, you know, understands and recognizes that everyone needs to be taken care of. And that sometimes there are some things that the public sector actually is fairly decent at. Not everything. I wouldn't want the government making cars. You know, that'd be silly. They'd be terrible cars. We can look at pictures from Russia in the 1970s to see what that would be like. But I don't really mind it if the government can figure out a better healthcare arrangement than what we have in the United States, which I think a place like Germany has figured out, which is actually a public-private partnership. It's not a single-payer system in Germany, but. You know, I think there are other ways to do things. The government's not always wrong. And we should be open-minded about that. That's really my argument more than anything. I want to be evidence-based. I want to be open-minded. I don't want to shut anything down immediately just because it offends our core principles. Like, I understand libertarians who argue that inherently taxes are like inherently, you know, they're inherently sort of invalid or immoral, you know, the non-aggression principle, like government shouldn't be able to take what you earned. I understand that principle and I even respect it because I feel that way about something like free speech. Like, I don't think the government should be able to censor anyone at any time, no matter how bad or awful whatever they're saying is. So I can relate that in my mind. I can say, well, they feel about taxes the way I feel about speech. So I get it. But I just, in reality though, I think, you know, it's just not practical. You know, it's probably better to have taxation. It leads to better net welfare for the society to have it. And of course, as we mentioned earlier, some forms of taxes are very counterproductive. They lead to behavior we don't want. We want to keep companies here. We want them to prosper. We want them to create jobs. But other forms, you know, are a little bit of a check on inequality, and they do help us fund things that I think are useful and good. I mean, I love my public library, you know. People forget about public libraries, but like, they're not that expensive to run. They're funded by, you know, usually a combination of sales and property taxes. And, you know, it's a pretty decent public service the government puts out there. And like, you know, not everything the government does is terrible, even though you and I can both name plenty of examples where it was terrible. So,
yeah. So I think that we, if in a very broad sense, agree on that kind of outline, that obviously I'm not an anarchist. I don't believe in zero taxes. I really hate taxes. And I do think there are some things you need a government to do and some public services. We probably disagree significantly on the scope of that or how far that should go. But that's probably a good place to wrap up the most serious portion of this conversation. So now I have to ask you the question that every guest on the podcast has to answer. What is your most controversial food take?
Oh, man, that's a really good one, honestly.
We've had some good ones on the show. We've had somebody likes to eat ramen packages raw. Another person like peanut butter mixed with bacon in a sandwich.
I mean, I feel like I'm pretty normy about food. I'm a pescatarian, right? So like, I eat like very basic seafood like scallops, but otherwise I don't really eat meat. So I don't know if that's controversial, just to be one of those. There aren't that many of us. There's like tons of like vegans are very outspoken and out there. And then there's like proud meat eaters. And then there's like me.
What's your rationale?
I think I have a mixture of rationales. Partly it's like animal welfare. Partly it's like health, you know. But I think animal welfare was probably what tipped me over into doing it. Just because, I don't know, I think that I understand why people ate meat historically. Like, sometimes you didn't have much of a choice. Like, where you were in the world, it's the only really sustainable thing to do to be healthy and to survive. But I kind of feel like we're reaching a point in human society where we can kind of move away from it. Like, we have plenty of alternatives now. We have technology. I mean, there's lab-grown meat now. Like, they're making that in Singapore. which, by the way, is another big capitalist success story. So you should be in favor of Singapore's lab-grown meat. And I feel like we can just do something that results in less animal suffering. I don't think we'll be able to eliminate it. I'm not, you know, it's a big part of human biology and history and existence. But at least we can move away from like industrial factory farming, and I think we can have a little bit more of a holistic approach to our diet. So
that will piss off the steak lovers and burger lovers even more than me eating my steak well done with ketchup. So I think that qualifies as a hot food take. Thanks so much for coming on.
Yeah, man, it was a fun time.
All right, everybody, that's it for today. Thanks for tuning in, and make sure you're subscribed on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. We'll talk again next week.
You are listening to Breaking Boundaries with Brad Palumbo.